So as I said, we're just going to jump in where we left off, okay? Now, just a second before we go, remember, he had just written, we read from that letter, and how he was going to stay among those Cherokee people and do his duty until forcibly removed, okay? So we jump in. On Sunday, March 13th, 1831, Samuel Worcester and several other missionaries were arrested by the Georgia Guard and marched more than 100 miles on foot before then being released. On July 7th of the same year, Samuel Worcester was once again arrested by the Georgia Guard. This time he was very roughly treated. He was insulted. He was put in a prison after a long march. No bail was set. He was subsequently released on July 23rd upon a writ of habeas corpus, but he was ordered to stand trial in September for, quote, criminal hostility to the humane policy of the general government, unquote. Now, through all of this, Ann Worcester was bedridden. During his absence due to mission duties, the Worcester's newest addition, little Jerusha, died. That is, on August 14th, 1831, Samuel was unable to make it back in time for the funeral. By the time he learned of the little girl's death, he made it back 2 days after he returned home. Ann Worcester, as I say, was bedridden, and they were all still grieving. The Georgia Guard showed up at his door again and arrested him. But then on hearing of the death of the little girl, a Governor Nelson of the Guard gave orders that Samuel should be released. On the 16th of September, 1831, the trial was held for Samuel Worcester. Dr. Elizur Butler, who was a co-laborer of Worcester's, the American board, and mission printer J.F. Wheeler, as well as eight others, that would be a total of 11. The eight others were from various denominations. They were involved in mission work among the Cherokee. The defendants were all found guilty. They were sentenced to 4 years of hard labor in the state penitentiary. During the trial, a General Hardin of Athens, Georgia, defended the men at his own request and his own expense. And here we would just note that when the Georgia Guard showed up prior to the trial to arrest Samuel, he very calmly gathered his family together in the room where his wife lay ill in order to conduct family worship one more time, which they always had, very faithful at family worship. And as he did this, he invited the soldiers to join them. Samuel then said a sad goodbye to his wife and little daughter, after which he was taken to the courtroom. Following the inevitable finding of guilt, it was decided that Samuel Worcester and also Elizur Butler and the other nine defendants would begin to march to the state penitentiary on the next day, Saturday, the 17th of September. But there was a delay of 1 day. They were being held in the local jail under the authority of the sheriff there. And so there was a delay of 1 day in drawing up the necessary papers and then delivering those documents to the sheriff so he would then be able to release them to the Georgia Guard. It was then decided, the papers came finally, but it was decided the prisoners would begin their trek the next day, Sunday morning, whereupon the missionaries drew up a petition immediately requesting the sheriff that they would not be forced to march on the Christian Sabbath. The reply of the sheriff included the following. Yours of this morning is received, and in reply, I have to state that your request is readily complied with. In taking this step, you must be sensible that I incur considerable responsibility. Another quote from the letter. It is not my desire to offer the least disrespect to religion through harsh treatment of any of its professors on account of conscientious scruples, much less to aggravate the sufferings of a condition already sufficiently painful. I take much pleasure with a hope that it will be approved by my fellow citizens in affording you this evidence how much your feelings and misfortunes can be respected by a public officer. Yours very respectfully, Thomas Worthy, Sheriff. He was worthy, wasn't he? And he took that opportunity to make a statement on what he thought of all of this. But he was just the local sheriff. On Monday, the 19th of September, the prisoners were put in chains, and a 165-mile forced march to the penitentiary at Milledgeville began. Right from the start, they were forced to listen to profanity and obscenities from one Sergeant Brooks of the Georgia Guard. When the convicted men were held at a Camp Gilmore during a stop on the way to the penitentiary, as this Sergeant Brooks imprisoned them, the missionaries, he declared, quote, "There is where all enemies of Georgia have to land, there and in hell." During this very short temporary stay, the missionaries requested in writing that they be allowed to hold a church service in the jail. The officer in charge, Colonel Nelson, wrote on their request, quote, "We view within request as an impertinent one. If your conduct be evidence of your character and the doctrines you wish to promulgate, we are sufficiently enlightened as to both. Our object is to restrain, not to facilitate your promulgation. If your object be true piety, you can enjoy it where you are. Were we hearers, we would not be benefited, devoid as we are of confidence in your honesty," unquote. When the prisoners and their guards finally came within sight of their destination, the very grim walls of the state penitentiary, one of the escorting guards called out in derision, "Fear not, little flock, it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom." Samuel Worcester later said of the guard mocking them in such a way, quote, "Little did he know the comfort he gave," unquote. When the 11 convicted men arrived at the gates of the penitentiary after that long, hard march, Georgia officials offered a full pardon to each and every one who would promise to leave the domain of the Cherokee of Georgia and never again return to it. Prior to and during this time, the gates of the prison were opened and shut several times for effect, each time making a very harsh, grating sound. Every one of the prisoners accepted the pardon with its terms, except for two men, Samuel Worcester and Dr. Butler, who refused repeated attempts to convince them to accept the terms of the pardon. Thus, the nine walked away free men, though one has to wonder how free they felt in their conscience, and the two missionary martyrs were taken into the penitentiary to begin their 4 years at hard labor. It should be noted that Samuel's wife, Anne, even though struggling at times and certainly at this time with illness, was entirely supportive of her husband's stand. The same can be said for the mission board. The tribulation of the Worcesters at this time was only made harder by the death of a very close and supportive brother in Christ, Jeremiah Everts, as well as another very supportive close friend of theirs, a godly Christian Cherokee. The Lord had providentially put in charge of the prison a warden whose heart he, the Lord, turned toward the two missionaries. This man, a Colonel Mills, was he a Christian? I don't know. I haven't had that much information on him. But certainly, as we said, even if he wasn't, the Lord turned his heart toward the missionaries. He not only allowed them to conduct services on the Lord's Day, he encouraged them to, and he asked them to preach to the assembled prisoners a half of the day. He encouraged them to do so, and they gladly did so. Consequently, as Miss Nevada Couch in her account recorded, quote, "A spirit of inquiry was to some extent awakened among the prisoners. A number were savingly and permanently benefited," unquote. After missionaries Worcester and Butler had been in prison at hard labor for 1 year, and Anne Worcester had recovered her health, the two wives, Worcester and Butler, Mrs. Worcester and Mrs. Butler, along with their children, made the trip to the penitentiary to visit their husbands. Again, 165-mile trip. During the journey, they were escorted by Christian friends of the families. The little children, upon seeing their fathers in such a setting and in prison clothes, shrank back from them, but they soon recovered. As for the reaction of the missionary wives, here we turn once more to the account written by Vada Couch. Quote, "Mrs. Worcester and Mrs. Butler visited the prison and were received kindly by Colonel Mills." And then she talks about what the moment when the wife saw their husbands. "Mrs. Butler was quite overcome, but Mrs. Worcester carried out her determination that no Georgian should see her tears ever, lest they should construe them as regretting her husband's course, which she never did," unquote. Now, here is as good a place as any to read a number of excerpts from a letter of Samuel Worcester from the prison. He wrote it from the penitentiary, and he sent it to the mission board. These are excerpts. "Great indeed is the comfort arising from the assurance that our lot is in this respect what that of Peter was, when prayer was made without ceasing of the church unto God for him." Because people were holding prayer meetings, and all over the East, and of course among the missionaries in various places. "We also enjoy peace of mind, which we hope proceeds from the favor God manifests to his own children." Another quote, "For myself, although I cannot say that I do not feel the pain of the deprivation of liberty and other trials necessarily connected with our situation, yet on the whole, I have enjoyed quite as large a share of happiness as has commonly fallen to my lot during an equal space of time. My cheerfulness has been uninterrupted without even an hour's depression of spirits." In regard to our situation in prison, he goes on for some time, including this, "we have opportunity to make some attempts at doing good among our fellow prisoners." Then he says this, "There are but 4 lodging rooms for the prisoners. Most of them lodge in 3 rooms, and between 2 of these is a free communication. Dr. Butler and I have separated our lodgings at the request of some of the prisoners for the sake of having evening worship each night in 2 rooms. On the Sabbath, we are in the same rooms as at night. By permission of the keepers, I preach in the morning in my own room and in the afternoon in the other, so that most of the prisoners who are disposed have the opportunity to hear. The number usually present in both rooms taken together is between 60 and 70. Dr. Butler also holds a meeting in the forenoon in the room where he lodges. Pray that these efforts may be followed with divine blessing." Another quote, "Let my name be sounded abroad as a weak, misguided enthusiast." That's some of people were calling him that. That was one of the better things they said, the enemies of this cause of Christ. "Let my name be sounded abroad as a weak, misguided enthusiast, yet a sincere lover of Jesus. Anything consistent with sincere devotion to the cause of the Redeemer, rather than told with the highest commendation man can bestow, and yet withhold the reputation of being a servant of Christ. Yet after all, it is a light thing to be judged of man's judgment. We stand or fall at a high tribunal." And then he signed it, "I remain yours in the bonds of the gospel, S.A. Worcester." During her husband's incarceration, in addition to her family duties, which she had many, and certain mission duties she had prior to his incarceration, she also had to do more work yet. I'm speaking now of Ann Worcester. She did all she could to make up for her husband's absence. Obviously, she couldn't preach the gospel, but she tried to do what she could, including writing up an extensive report for the War Department in response to their request, or even demand, but their request, we'll put it that way, on the Indian schools maintained by the missionaries. I say demand because if they requested a report, it had to be done. Now, at the same time, there were ongoing efforts to liberate Worcester and Butler, but none of these were availing. Georgia stood firm on this. They had to agree to the terms of that would allow them to have a pardon. They had to agree to leave Cherokee country. They had to agree to stop preaching then and teaching the Cherokee. They had to do everything that Georgia required, and they wouldn't do it. And so they remained in prison. But they were greatly encouraged to know that prayer meetings were being held all around the country at that time, really. The oldest daughter of Samuel and Ann Worcester, Ann Eliza, who became Mrs. Robertson and a missionary wife herself, wrote much later of her father and Dr. Butler. Quote, "They would neither forsake their work or perjure themselves, so took the penalty and appealed to the Supreme Court." The case is Worcester versus State of Georgia. "The decision of the United States Supreme Court was given in an order that the missionaries must be set at liberty. The state of Georgia refused to release them except at the point of bayonet." And that was literally what the state of Georgia said, the officials had answered. They wouldn't release them, quote, except at the point of bayonet, unquote. Their case was brought to the Supreme Court by a writ of error. On the 20th of February, 1832, it was argued during the course of 3 days by a William Wirt and John Sargent on their behalf. And here we want to turn to Joseph Tracy and his history of the American Board. On the 3rd of March, Chief Justice Marshall pronounced the decision of the court in favor of the missionaries, declaring the laws of Georgia extending her jurisdiction over the Cherokee country to be repugnant to the Constitution, treaties, and laws of the United States, and therefore null and void. The mandate of the court was immediately issued, reversing and annulling the judgment of the Supreme Court of Georgia and ordering that all proceedings on the indictment against the missionaries, quote, do forever cease, unquote, and that they, quote, be and hereby are dismissed therefrom, unquote. Nevertheless, the Supreme Court of Georgia refused to obey this U.S. Supreme Court order, as did the civil government of Georgia. As far as President Andrew Jackson, he is reported to have said when hearing of the Supreme Court ruling, John Marshall has made his decision, now let him enforce it. But still, widely known and continuing incarceration of Worcester and Butler was a problem for the governor and the officials of Georgia, since the situation was drawing so much national attention. There were even those within Georgia, of course, I speak of the white people now, that were upset with this, who were Christians and some of the good people of Georgia. And so it was an ongoing problem. The missionaries had many friends who agitated for their release. Not too many in Georgia, maybe, but some even there. Now, finally, claiming the missionaries had appealed to the magnanimity of the state of Georgia, the order was given to release them. On the 14th of January, 1833, the officer in charge of the state penitentiary, Colonel Mills, received the order to release Worcester and Butler. They had spent over 16 months in the penitentiary at hard labor, but they hadn't given in. Meanwhile, the pressure on the Cherokee by the state of Georgia and elsewhere, of course, from Andrew Jackson and those in favor of removal, the pressure for them to sign a treaty in which they agreed to this just intensified. Certainly the state of Georgia had used every manner of heavy-handed coercion, unjust laws, unlawful edicts, and even threats of all kinds in the attempt to force the Cherokee to agree to make null and void the treaty which the federal government and the Cherokee had entered into so many years before, the treaty which assured the Cherokee of their ownership of the land that they occupied, their farms, their plantations, their towns. They had developed this. They had done everything you would think that would commend them to the rest, to all Americans, as being those that were really, really beneficial to have in the midst of the country, and certainly in time to take into citizenship, which is where many wanted to do. As far as the rest of the country. Now, for his part, Samuel Worcester, strong as his feelings were with regard to the rights of the Cherokee, he struggled not to harm the cause of the gospel, even though he had made known his convictions. And this was even more important now, because now there's two parties among the Cherokee at odds with one another. There are those who felt it was best to just give in to the demands of Georgia. They're going to win anyway. We move to the West on the best terms we can get. And then these are the Treaty Party, by the way. They're called the Treaty Party. It was very small in number. The Treaty Party felt the handwriting's on the wall. We're going. Let's go with the best terms possible. The Treaty Party was led by three Cherokees whose English names were Major Ridge, John Ridge, his son, and Elias Bodenot. And Samuel Worcester was not in favor of what his friend was doing, but he said it is out of his conscience. It's not out of anything but conscience, what Elias is doing, but he was against it. And it might be interesting to you that Elias Bodenot was brother to the famous Stand Waite. You've heard of him. As for Major Ridge, you might say, how did he get major? Is that his name? Is it a rank? Well, he had fought with distinction under the then General Andrew Jackson against the Creek Indians in the Creek War years earlier. At that time, he was given the name Major, and he used it the rest of his life. His Cherokee name was, I'm not going to try to pronounce it, but what it means is he who slays the enemy in his path. And so you've got the treaty faction. Again, they're pro-treaty. They're quite small. And you have his leaders, John Ridge, the son of Major Ridge, and Elias Boudinot. They weren't the only leaders, but they were the main ones. Then arrayed against the treaty party was the Cherokees, who were determined never to give up their lands and homes. This party represented the vast, vast majority of the Cherokees. It was led by the principal chief of the Cherokees, John Ross, English name. Now, we spoke of him earlier, of course. So at this point, here's the two parties. The latter one was by far the greater. That was against the treaty, against removal. Enter now a very unprincipled man with a reputation for shady political activity, the Reverend Mr. J.F. Schermerhorn. He was appointed by President Jackson to get, in truth, to pressure John Ridge of the Treaty Party to sign an agreement for removal, even though the Ridge faction represents so few Cherokee. And also, even though John Ross was the Cherokee's principal chief and occupied the executive office of their government. In July of 1835, delegations headed by Ross and Ridge, I know, Ross, Ridge, hard to keep them apart, isn't it? Well, Ross is anti-treaty, Ridge is pro-treaty. And they headed for Washington to meet with Schermerhorn in Washington, D.C. He used every trick in the book and all the pressure he could to convince the Ridge delegation. He didn't bear down on the Ross delegation as much. He must have seen it wasn't going to pay off, but he worked on the Ridge delegation to get them to enter into an agreement for removal. They agreed. So you have one party agreeing, the other party not agreeing. What kind of agreement is that? I mean, as far as of the two delegations, and the part that doesn't agree is by far the vast majority of the Cherokee as represented. So the Ridge Party agreed, but only on the condition that the whole body of the Cherokee people have opportunity to familiarize themselves with all the terms of the removal agreement, and then their leaders in full council decide for or against. So they agreed that they were for removal, and they wanted to enter into a treaty. They didn't enter into it right then. It must be heard by full council representing all the Cherokee and then decide. This is how it started out. Now, when the council was finally held, the Reverend Schermerhorn was present, and he did his utmost to pressure the Cherokee to decide for removal. The result was that the council, representing the great mass of the Cherokee people, refused to make void the old treaty with the federal government and agree to removal from their lands. Reporting on this development to Washington, Schermerhorn wrote, quote, "The Lord is able to overrule all things for good." No doubt you find that as disgusting as I do, that comment. Schermerhorn's next move was to call a meeting of the Cherokee people and their chiefs in their capital of New Echota. This meeting took place in December of 1835 of the then 17,000 Cherokee in Georgia. 17,000 at that time. Later, when the removal takes place, some have left, some have headed for the hills, 16,000 then. But of the 17,000 Cherokee in Georgia at that time, a very small number showed up for the meeting. Estimates range from 100 of the 17,000 to 300. The principal chief, John Ross, refused to attend, as did other Cherokee officials. At this meeting, Schermerhorn presented the Cherokees on hand a treaty. He had a treaty ready, treaty for removal, in which the Cherokee Nation would cede to the United States the whole remaining territory of the Cherokee east of the Mississippi, 7 million acres at that time, for the sum of $5 million, and agree to remove to the western lands within no more than 2 years. Major Ridge, his son John Ridge, and Elias Boudinot signed the treaty as representatives of the whole Cherokee Nation, when in truth they had no authority really to do this. They had no authority to decide for the nation, nor did the nation as a whole want that treaty. After signing, Major Ridge prophetically announced, "I have signed my death warrant." Consequently, Chief John Ross presented a petition against the treaty for obvious reasons. It was signed by 16,000 Cherokee. A General Wool, who was in charge of the federal troops in that part of the country, forwarded the petition to Washington, and for his efforts, he received a rebuke from President Jackson. Army Major W.M. Davis, who also was not enthusiastic about what was going on here, but he was appointed to enroll the Cherokees for removal. He wrote to the Secretary of War this, I'll read some excerpts from what he wrote. "I conceive that my duty to the president, to yourself, and to my country reluctantly compels me to make a statement of facts in relation to a meeting of a small number of Cherokee at New Echota last December who were met by Mr. Schermerhorn and articles of a general treaty entered into between them for the whole Cherokee nation. Sir, the paper, called a treaty, is no treaty at all, because not sanctioned by the great body of the Cherokee and made without their participation or assent. I solemnly declare to you that upon its reference to the Cherokee people, it would be instantly rejected by 9/10 of them, and I believe by 19/20 of them. There were not present at the conclusion of the treaty more than 100 Cherokee voters, although the weather was everything that could be desired. Mr. Schermerhorn's apparent design was to conceal the real number present. The Cherokee," I'm reading excerpts now, "the Cherokee are a peaceable, harmless people, but you may drive them to desperation, and this treaty cannot be carried into effect except by the strong arm of force." Nevertheless, this bogus treaty was ratified by the U.S. Senate May 23, 1836, but by only one vote. Treaties with other nations, as you may know, are ratified by the U.S. Senate only. But a state lottery, as we told you earlier, had already been held by Georgia for the homes, farms, and plantations of the Cherokee, and some whites had already, in anticipation of the treaty passing, they had already begun, prior to that treaty passing, prior to what took place here, they had begun to seize Cherokee homes and lands before any removal had even taken place, let alone had the treaty been signed. Cherokees, even women, were being mistreated and abused by local officials. The Cherokee newspaper, the Phoenix, was suppressed. The mission press at New Echota was confiscated. Dr. Butler and his family had already been driven from their mission station, whereupon they then went to Brainerd Mission Station just beyond the border of Georgia. Although Ann Worcester had just recently given birth to another child and was again struggling with poor health, the Worcesters were driven out of their mission home months before the signing of the treaty. It was claimed that some white family or a white man had gotten this from that lottery. And it was all just it was all just part of a campaign to get Worcester out of there and also to seize all this Cherokee land and homes. It was all illegal. It was all unlawful. Well, Samuel then also was forced to retire to Brainerd, and he labored there for a time until it became clear he was never going to be allowed by Georgia officials to reenter Cherokee land in that state, even to at least minister as he could among the Cherokee prior to the inevitable removal. As we say, he was driven out before the treaty was even signed. So the decision was made by the mission board for the Worcesters to travel to Indian Territory in Oklahoma. There was a large tract set up where they were going to transplant these tribes, not just the Cherokee, and they had already been doing it with Choctaw, Chickasaw, and others, and there were already Cherokee there that had just decided to go. We're not talking as much from Georgia as other places, some from Georgia, a few. And so it was decided they should go there and do what they could among the few Cherokee there already, and also to set up things to minister and to to resume his ministry among the Cherokee of Georgia when they get there, because they knew they were going to inevitably end up there. In April of 1835, Samuel and Anne and their three little daughters began that very long journey in a two-seated horse-drawn wagon of sorts. That journey to Indian Territory in Oklahoma, which was still a territory itself. And this was the territory, the Indian territory, the part that had been designated for all the Cherokee. This is where they were headed. As I say, there were land areas in Indian Territory assigned for the Choctaw, Chickasaw, Creek, Seminole, later for other tribes as well. But most of the Seminole, once the treaty with them went into effect and removal was passed, they retreated into the Florida swamps, and they fought for years, fought all efforts to remove them. They eventually, many of them ended up in Oklahoma, though. But the Worcesters arrived at Dwight on May 29th, 51 days after leaving Brainerd. At this time, Samuel was 37 years old. Now, for various reasons, Dwight was not the place for the mission house to be set up. It wasn't the place that could be the headquarters of the missionary efforts of the American Board among the Cherokee. So Samuel set about scouting the country for the best location for the mission station. He traveled hundreds of miles on horseback during that quest. After another necessary move to a place called Union, Samuel finally received permission. He found a place. He received permission from the Cherokee Nation to locate the mission station along with the mission house, and of course, school and Prince Shop, and in due time, a church that would be built by Samuel and whatever other buildings they needed or desired to have, all at a location at a fork of the Illinois River, which he chose and he named Park Hill. A dispensary would also be set up from which Samuel, who had some basic medical training, would dispense medicines to the Cherokee in need. And soon after it was established, Park Hill, in time, there would be a small post office also set up. And then Park Hill, from then on, would be the missionary home of Anne and Samuel, from which they ministered among the Cherokee, particularly Samuel, of course, and Anne doing what she could. And they labored there the rest of their lives, and there is where they were buried. Now, Samuel had arranged for his books. He had a printing press lined up. He had paper for the press. He had household goods, all to be sent by steamboat and then brought overland to Oklahoma Territory. But the steamboat sunk. The press was lost. Very little was saved of the rest of the Worcester cargo. And what was saved, a portion of that was stolen. But, as always, Samuel accepted the loss. He didn't waste any time fretting over it. He wasn't of that type. A new press was sent eventually, along with the first shipment of many shipments of paper for the press, which would be requested. I say many shipments would be requested and sent over the years from the East. And even as he labored in his preaching then and evangelizing and translating and his doctoring and his printing work, as well as also building necessary buildings and other manual labor, as he, of course, was getting things ready for the great mass of Cherokee to come, Samuel set about to also dig a well, as if he didn't have enough to do, but this would make it so they didn't have to carry water from the river. He worked as he had time, as time permitted. It took, I think it was 2 years. The last 12 feet of this, that he was sinking, this shaft, had to go through flint rock, which had to be blasted and then removed. He ordered a pump and pump rod from the East, but he sent a drawing. It was a difficult situation. He studied it. He customized a pump rod and gave all the dimensions and asked them to build it this way. They did. They sent it. He got it set up. It worked just fine. A fourth child was born at Park Hill as well. This boy was named Leonard after Samuel's father. Eventually, another boy would also be born, a boy the Worcesters named John Orr. By the summer of 1837, Samuel had organized a church which consisted of 19 members, 6 whites, 10 Cherokee, and 3 brethren who were black. At this time, Samuel was conducting church services at three different locations in the territory already and laboring at sharing the gospel wherever he could to the Cherokee and by whatever means as well, such as tracts. He made a great use of tracts. And to just pause for a minute here and review, it was 1836 that the Treaty of New Echota had been signed by Major Ridge, his son John, as well as Elias Bodenot. Congress had ratified the bogus treaty then, but the great removal hadn't taken place yet. Now, in May of 1838, because the Removal Act has been passed, the treaty, the bogus treaty, was signed. In May of 1838, President Martin Van Buren sent General Winfield Scott and 7,000 federal troops to force the Cherokee to go, because they weren't going. They refused to leave. And so he sent troops, armed troops. As Cherokees were removed from their homes and farms, whites would then immediately take possession. This rounding up process took months, and during that time, the Cherokee, as they were being rounded up, were put into stockades during that whole long, hot summer and into the fall. Chief John Ross was living on the Tennessee-Georgia border because his beautiful farm had been taken over by whites previously already. The Georgia Guard went there and seized him and forcibly brought him in. Far from all the federal troops ordered to take part in this business were in favor of it. For instance, Army Private John Burnett wrote this: "Men working in the fields were arrested and driven to the stockades. Women were dragged from their homes by soldiers whose language they couldn't understand. Children were often separated from their parents and driven into the stockades with only a scarf or blanket and the earth for their pillow. And the old and infirm were prodded with bayonets to hasten them to the stockade." Cherokees were confined there as more and more of them were brought in. I say it was a long, hot summer. Then finally, in the fall, it was a foolish time to start this 1,200-mile trek to Oklahoma. Men, women, children, old people, infants. Even on the way, there were babies born. But they were finally started to Oklahoma Territory. Of that sad morning, that same Private Burnett wrote, quote, "And in the chill of a drizzling rain on an October morning, I saw them loaded like cattle or sheep into wagons." They had a certain amount of wagons, some walk, some rode horses, a few rode horses, a lot of walking, and then also there were wagons, and started toward the west. I'll never forget the sadness of that morning. Chief John Ross led in prayer, and when the bugles sounded and the wagons started rolling, many of the children rose to their feet and waved goodbye forever. Many of these people didn't even have blankets, and many of them had been driven from home barefoot. It was just completely reckless of the lives and well-being of the Cherokee to start them on their journey that late in the season. There were concerned whites at various levels of government who protested, and citizens protested even. They warned of the folly and cruelty of the decision, but the federal officials who ordered it were adamant. And, of course, it was the same with the officials of the state of Georgia. The Cherokee must go without any delay for any reason. Much has been written about what has become known as the Trail of Tears. Some, I suppose, could be exaggerated, but the reality is the Cherokee people suffered greatly from hunger, malnutrition, disease, and exposure. It would seem to be an established fact that about 4,000 Cherokees of the 16,000 died on the Trail of Tears during the some 5 months it took to reach Oklahoma Territory. Along the way, church services would be held by various companies of the Cherokee, and they, day after day, headed toward Oklahoma. Upon the arrival of the Cherokees in their designated area of the Indian Territory of Oklahoma, Samuel Worcester was there, and he immediately resumed his ministry among them. But before we say more on that, we're going to pause in order to sum up the situation, because the situation made the missionaries' labor that much harder. To begin with, there was a certain amount of friction between the newly arrived Cherokees from Georgia and those Cherokees called the Old Settlers who had removed to the designated Cherokee lands in Oklahoma earlier, some years earlier, from states other than Georgia. And the tension and attendant problems went on for some years. But then there was something worse. There was the Treaty Party and those against it. And there were hard feelings and animosity directed by the great majority of the Cherokee against that small Treaty Party who signed the Treaty of Echota. On the morning of June 22nd, 1839, the Treaty Party leaders, Major Ridge, John Ridge, were killed. Elias Bodenat was also killed. In his case, hatchets were used. All these murders were done by unknown members of the anti-removal party. These murders were done after the three were condemned to death secretly under what the Cherokee call blood law. The murders caused even increased tension, of course, as well as a certain amount of violence, mutual retaliations. And so the rift between the parties got even wider then. All this added to the challenges faced by Samuel Worcester as he faithfully labored for the Lord among the Cherokee, all the Cherokee. And the death of Elias Bodenat, of course, Samuel's friend and very skilled co-laborer in the translation work of the Cherokee Bible, was a very hard blow. But in answer to much prayer, the Lord soon provided another dedicated, very, very skilled Christian Cherokee who co-labored with Samuel in the translation work. On July 12, 1839, the Old Settlers and the Cherokee from Georgia met on a council ground on the Illinois River. Here they agreed to join together in, quote, one body politic under the style and title of the Cherokee Nation, unquote. Subsequent to that council, in September the same year, a site for a capital, I believe there was already a town there, it was selected as the Cherokee Nation's new capital. I don't know if I can pronounce it, Talega. And a new constitution for the nation was drawn up. It was like the old one, really. It was ratified in June of 1840. And you still had tension between the old settlers and the new, but it didn't instantly disappear by this union, but the divisions did disappear gradually and more till they were truly one people. And the same can be said with regard to the tension and animosity between the Treaty Party and the anti-Treaty Party, but that took much longer. Now, in the spring of 1840, Ann Worcester gave birth to their sixth child, a little girl named Mary Eleanor. But after that, Ann sank very quickly and died just a few hours later. She was only 40 years old. To the mission board, Samuel declared that he wrote from, quote, the depths of affliction. He went on to say, it has pleased my heavenly Father to give me a wife and my children, a mother of no ordinary excellence and value. The Lord gave and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. More to the letter than that, but those are two excerpts. So here was Samuel, deeply bereaved, a widower, and yet at the same time, an exceedingly busy missionary, and he has six little children. For the sake of the children, a year after Ann's death, Samuel married Miss Ermina Nash, who had been teaching at an Indian school near Honey Creek. She accepted his proposal of marriage with the full knowledge. He didn't deceive her. He made sure she understood she could never occupy the same place in his heart as Ann. Of his decision to enter into this marital union, Samuel wrote, while I do not by any means feel that the loss which I and my children have sustained by the removal of my first companion is now or ever can be fully repaired, yet I feel that I have much reason for gratitude that Providence has thrown in my way so excellent a woman to be a partner for me and a mother to them. Ermina was no match for Anne with respect to natural gifts, but she was an excellent adopted mother to Samuel's children, and this is what he felt he needed with the six little children. They had no children themselves together. Until the end of his life in 1859, Samuel Worcester labored on preaching at the Mission Church and elsewhere. He provided the overall leadership of the American Board Mission in Indian Territory. He preached elsewhere. He engaged in evangelism, I say, without the church. He preached the gospel in various places. He witnessed the Cherokee individuals wherever he could in groups. He translated gospel tracts and Christian literature into Cherokee, which were then printed in the mission print shop and distributed. And he continued this careful, reverent translation of a Cherokee Bible. It was a slow process because he wanted it to be faithful. Now, I say he had oversight of all the Indian missions there of the American board in that territory. I probably shouldn't have put it that way, of the Cherokee mission work of the American board. But the thing is, they also asked him. They had other men in charge, Choctaw and the other Chickasaw and so forth. But they asked him constantly for his opinion. And with regard to missionaries and other things, so he had some oversight that way. And then year by year, as Samuel labored, yes, Cherokee men and women and young people, one here, one there, were brought to faith in Christ by the effectual power of the Holy Spirit through the preaching and witnessing of Samuel Worcester. And no doubt some black and white persons were also converted to Christ. The mission board back east relied on Samuel, as we said, to oversee mission work among the Cherokee in the Oklahoma Territory, and also the schools and the churches that began to, as Cherokee were being saved, of course, then this place and that place, there'd be enough, they would start a church. And Samuel would be the one that would be part of, like a Paul, and the raising up of these churches, the overseeing of them, getting them in the right order. And he was consulted always by the American board concerning missionary appointments, of course, among the Cherokee and even among other nations by the American board, Indian nations. And he was always, he had this faithful, straightforward nature. And he had such a concern for the work of the Lord that he insisted all sent as missionaries must be sound in doctrine, sound in practice, and always fit to be a missionary. If they weren't, he would simply state it. Samuel was consulted, I say, by the board for his opinion, even on possible missionary appointments to other Indian tribes, which were relocated to Indian Territory in Oklahoma. I want to just read an excerpt of Samuel Worcester's assessment of a missionary to the Osage Indians. He was already a missionary there. His name was Redfield, but the mission board proposed to put him in charge of the entire Osage mission effort. This is what, at least part of what Samuel Worcester wrote. Mr. Redfield would not do. He travels and allows his teams to be driven on the Sabbath. He is too worldly-minded and has been too much in the habit of treating the Osages as a little below the human race to do very good among them. Nor is his wife adopted to the work. I say, he was straightforward. And we say more power to him. Samuel Worcester also preached the scriptural truth concerning Romanism. Now, when it came to contending for the faith and protecting the churches from any and all who would bring the leaven of error into them, he feared no man. And he didn't hesitate to take even preemptive action to protect the church, purchased with the precious blood of Christ. Here's an excerpt of another letter of Samuel to the mission board in the East. It's about a Mrs. Chamberlain. She's a more elderly woman. Mrs. Chamberlain, widow of Reverend William Chamberlain, former missionary with us, is making a long visit to her son near Fairfield Station, who is as yet a member of the church and holds the office of deacon. So you got a former missionary, a reverend, and you've got his son, the deacon, and here's the wife. Unhappily, Mrs. C. has become a subject of the spirit-wrapping delusion and imagines herself to have received various communications from her deceased husband and her father. Another excerpt. I presented last Sunday a resolution to the church for adoption to the effect that we would regard any member of the church who should either pretend to act as a medium or through any such pretended medium pretend to consult with the dead as guilty of a disciplinable offense and dealt with and ejected from the church. He didn't say, well, she's older, well, we'll just... No, he wasn't taking chances like that. He was following what the Bible tells to do. He did warn her as well. Samuel strongly believed also that Christians of all races ought to abstain from alcoholic beverages. Certainly, he was greatly concerned about the destructive effects among Indians when strong drink was introduced to them by whites that wanted to make money, of course. Early on, he established a temperance union, which in time had a number of chapters, all of which accepted red, white, and black men and women. He wrote a Cherokee language tract on temperance. He spoke against the consumption of alcoholic beverages, scripturally speaking. He preached. Samuel even wrote a Cherokee language temperance song, and he organized youth activities to educate them on the danger of fermented beverages. The temperance pledge of the society is as follows, and I think it's a good pledge for Christians today. We hereby solemnly pledge ourselves that we will never use, nor buy, nor sell, nor give, nor receive as a drink any whiskey, brandy, gin, rum, wine, fermented cider, strong beer, or any kind of intoxicating liquor. As soon as possible, Samuel appointed capable Cherokee leaders for the Temperance Union chapters so he wouldn't be too drawn away from his work, of course, his gospel labors and other mission work, but he continued to oversee that as well. And it did bear much fruit. Many were brought into it and signed the pledge, and the great majority kept it. And so it saved many, many individuals and families from sorrow and disgrace and ruin. Satan didn't have a chance to use alcoholic beverages to ruin these Cherokee and draw them away from Christ even, or from the preaching of the word at least. In 1852, the Indian Bureau of the federal government requested a report from Samuel on the work of the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions among the Cherokee and Oklahoma Indian Territory. We'll read just a few excerpts. It'll be enough to read because we have a very long letter here from Samuel back to the Indian Bureau. His response to that request. Park Hill, August 30th, 1852. Sir, the AB of C for FM, that's the mission board, has still under its care in the Cherokee Nation five stations, Dwight, Lee's Creek, Fairfield, Park Hill, and Honey Creek. At the last, they could support a native preacher, Reverend John Huss, remember him from earlier, who has the pastoral care of a church at that station, that would be Honey Creek. At each of the other stations, they have an ordained missionary with a family and a school taught gratuitously by a female missionary. Another excerpt. At Park Hill is a printing press employing a portion of the time in printing books in the Cherokee language, and of course, along with everything else, with the tracts and everything, but also these books on Christian subjects. He goes on to give a report on each station. Then he says the church at Park Hill, where I am located, contained 50 members less than a year ago. Our school during the winter term had 31 scholars in all and an average attendance of 20. During the last term, the number was 38 and the average 26. Of the whole number during the year, 23 were boarded in the neighborhood at the expense of parents of friends, a circumstance which goes to show the prevailing desire among the Cherokees for the education of their children. Remember, there are other schools by now set up as well. A new house of worship is in the process of erection, built by subscription, in printing in the Cherokee language. And then he goes on to list what they printed. It's a long list here. He has 5,000 copies of Paul's epistle to Timothy, 5,000 copies of the epistle of Peter. This is in the Cherokee language because he's been translating. 5,000 copies of a portion of Exodus, Almanac for 1853, 1,000 copies. This was just this year. 1,000 copies, and then all the various tracts. He wrote a great many tracts, not only gospel tracts, but tracts on various important subjects for the Cherokees with regard to a right way of living and a scriptural way of living. And also the Cherokee hymn book, which he wrote, he wrote not only that, he worked on the music. He taught himself about music. This man was remarkable. But the Cherokee hymn book, he wrote all these hymns and put them together in the Cherokee language. They had printed a number of those that year. And we mentioned the almanac. I want to say a word on that. The almanac in the Cherokee language is a story in itself. Samuel, set about to give them an almanac. He thought this would be very helpful for them. And he had to do all sorts of research. He wrote letters to various persons that could help him when it came to facts of weather and weather patterns and all sorts of things. And he wrote the almanac himself. He included all sorts of scientific and practical information valuable, for instance, for agriculture. He included information on weather patterns. He had passages of scripture with short exhortations. Comments on the need and value of temperance were in there. He had information on the Cherokee Nation itself. And he wrote this in English and Cherokee together in columns. Now, where he found time to do that, I don't know. Then in 1855, Samuel Worcester was bitten by a dog, which very apparently had rabies. And all the animals bitten by that dog had died. Samuel fell very ill. He was near death for some time, but he survived. The Lord healed him. It was by the power of God. To this day, there's no effective treatment, you know. Once that is established in a person, and over history, only a small number have ever survived at that point, but Samuel Worcester did. After Samuel survived that rabies infection, then he came down with inflammatory rheumatism, which is a very sore trial for him, as more and more it slowed him down, and then considerably, and it made it very hard and painful for him to write. Of his increasing trials, the faithful minister of Christ wrote, "We have no immunity by reason of any sacredness of function. No, God would teach us all to be ever looking for that other country." In the fall of 1857, Samuel received notice that he had been given a Doctor of Divinity degree, and well-earned, from the University of Vermont. Here we include the letter he wrote to the mission board in response to that development. Park Hill, September 1, 1857, Reverend S.B. Treat, "Dear Sir, I am informed that the University of Vermont, hard pushed it would seem for timber to make doctors, have dubbed me D.D. Please omit that mark in the publication of the board and in superscribing and addressing letters to me, yours truly, S.A. Worcester." There was an incident where someone addressed him as Dr. Worcester. He snapped at that person, "Don't doctor me." He didn't like the title. By this time, of course, he's quite old. The messenger, as his Cherokee name was, knew he would soon be leaving this world for glory. And his concern was to finish the translation of the Bible into Cherokee, a faithful translation into Cherokee. He knew his time was limited. The ravages of severe rheumatism caused him to be much bedridden, but from his bed he continued to receive reports on the mission and to issue instructions on everything, on printing and giving advice and helping where he could, and of course still, as I say, issuing instructions. He also received those seeking counsel or simply to have fellowship with him. Family worship continued as led by him from his bed. Then carbuncles developed on his back, and so he had to lie on his face all the time. Carbuncles are groups of boils, and they're very, very painful. They're connected under the skin. They can be extremely painful. So he laid on his face, and he had to lay there as he worked on that translation with a Cherokee Christian brother. Friends urged Samuel not to work so hard, since they said, "Well, this is injuring your already frail body." His reply was typical and as follows: "I would be willing to live for years suffering as I do now if I could only finish the work of giving the Cherokees the Bible." Here we include an excerpt from the biographical account of Samuel Worcester given by the Cherokee girl, Nevada Couch. "But his anxious mind labored earnestly in interpreting and giving to the Cherokee the Bible. He suffered a long and painful illness during which, on his bed, he continued his work with the interpreter on the Bible in Cherokee as long as he could use his pen, and then dictated as long as he could command his thoughts for the work, the while being obligated to lie in one position and that on his face. In the spring of 1859, all that was left to be translated into Cherokee was part of the Epistle to the Hebrews, a part of the book of Revelation, and the Epistle of Jude." Samuel wrote this. I had much set my heart on the completion of the work, but God is wise. To him I would humbly submit the case, chiefly praying that whatever time and through whatever suffering he shall see fit to call me away, I may be enabled by his grace to bear all without murmuring and to honor him whether in life or in death. Samuel wrote his last letter to the mission board in early April 1859. The letter was clearly written with much struggle, and it's hard to read because it's almost unlegible. He struggled so. What was the purpose of that last letter that he struggled to write? To urge the board to send a missionary to Honey Creek because Samuel felt there was a great need for a man at that location. And knowing his time was short as he labored on the Bible translation, he also spent time with his designated successor, a missionary named Reverend Torrey. Samuel laid out a plan for the transfer of the mission into his care. He gave him instructions for everything from printing runs to preaching to everything. And all other pressing work, he spent much time with Reverend Torrey, giving him all possible benefit of his own missionary labors and the wisdom and knowledge gained by, what would it be, 34 years, I believe, of mission experience. He also prayed much with and for this man who would step into his shoes. As the time drew near to pass over into the heavenly promised land, Samuel exhibited a perfect peace, an explicit trust in the gospel promise of the Lord, and he exclaimed, "I shall be satisfied when I awake in thy likeness." On April 20th, 1859, Samuel Worcester ended his pilgrim life in this fallen world, and he joined his beloved Anne and all the redeemed saints in glory. As he directed, his body was buried beside his first wife, Anne, in the cemetery of the Park Hill Church, which he, Samuel, under Christ, had raised up, literally built and raised up. The man Samuel had trained to take over the mission work for him, Reverend Torrey, wrote of Samuel's death to the mission board. Here are some excerpts from that letter. "The Lord has removed the main prop of our mission and taken our dear brother Worcester to himself. He died on Wednesday, April 20th at 6:15 in the morning. His death was very quiet, entirely without a struggle. He suffered intensely, but bore all with wonderful patience and cheerfulness." Then he talks about Samuel's determination to get that Bible translated. He says he clung to it more closely, to that labor, than he clung to life. And then another excerpt, "Of the magnitude of the loss we have sustained in this bereavement, it is needless for me to speak. It is a loss to this people which I fear can never be repaired. The mission work of the Cherokee Nation, Indian Territory, Oklahoma, had begun in the worst of conditions, with the Cherokee torn by division, in some cases very deadly division, animosities and hatred, and everything in a turmoil. But the messenger, the missionary Samuel Worcester, pressed forward to work in spite of all difficulties, including slanderous attacks against his own character. At the time of Samuel's death, the mission work of the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions among the Cherokee was flourishing, with schools, churches, a print shop, and a seminary. The record shows Samuel Worcester was scriptural and sound in his doctrine, preaching, and ministry practice. While being a minister of the Congregational Church on missionary journeys, he willingly attended faithful Presbyterian churches if there was no congregational church available. He maintained warm relationships with faithful Baptists as well. And yet at the same time, he took a firm, decided, consistent stand for the faith once delivered unto the saints against all who would corrupt that faith, who would plant the leaven of error in it. In his preaching, he emphasized the absolute necessity of the new birth. Those who confess to having repented of their sins, believed on Christ and his blood and righteousness alone for their salvation, and who gave clear evidence of being born again, these he admitted into church membership, but only after a thorough examination and their agreeing to accept and hold to the church's covenant and the confession of faith. This man did whatever was needed to forward the work, the mission work among the Cherokee, and to help them, to build up the mission work, I say, among them. If carpentry was needed, he was a carpenter. If agricultural teaching was needed, he taught agricultural practices. Translating, printing, dispensing medical advice and medicines, mediating disputes, offering wise counsel, overseeing the temperance union, as well as the mission school and all the schools that he helped start, writing reports to the Indian Bureau and mission board. The list goes on and on. One granddaughter speaks of the family visiting there, and she speaks of grandpa going out to milk the cows. He did whatever had to be done. But always and ever, at the heart of his work was preaching. Preaching the gospel. Bible teaching, evangelism, and the translating of the Bible and tracts into Cherokee. These were his main concern, as well as planting churches and overseeing them, and ever striving to never neglect the all-important ministry of the word. We have this statement by one of the daughters of Samuel Worcester concerning her father's faithful preaching. I wish to mention a characteristic of my father's preaching, which I never saw so strongly exhibited in any other man. It was his living faithfully up to the declaration, I am determined to know nothing among you save Jesus Christ and him crucified. He made this mean that he would never preach a sermon on whatever subject in which he would not, before its close, so plainly bring in redemption by Christ as that all might embrace it if they could. His skill in making this come in naturally with whatever subject or text he might be handling seemed to me remarkable. We close with this excerpt from the words etched into a memorial shaft that was raised at Park Hill in his honor. Reverend D.D. S.A. Worcester, for 34 years a missionary of the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions among the Cherokee. To his work they owe their Bible and hymn book. To this good man, to such good men as have been sent to us, this is the Cherokee, us, as missionaries and missionary teachers, we owe largely our advanced position among Indian tribes and the precious advantages we now enjoy. We echo the sentiment of Dr. Alden, Secretary of the American Board, in his recent address at the 75th anniversary of Park Street Church, Common Boston, Park Street Church in Boston, this is not in Oklahoma, where Dr. Worcester was ordained as a minister of the gospel and as a foreign missionary. Let his name, Samuel A. Worcester, and his history never be forgotten. May the Academy, whose anniversary we celebrate today, be worthy of the name it bears, committed to every good work and struggling heroically even at the cost of suffering to be a blessing to the Cherokee Nation for whom the noble Worcester gave his life. And to this day, the Cherokee still honor the name of Samuel Worcester, the Cherokee messenger, as a firm and faithful friend of the Cherokee Nation and a faithful follower of Christ.